Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Chris Bohjalian is the best-selling author of The Flight Attendant and The Lioness. His latest is The Princess of Las Vegas, where a Princess Diana impersonator and her estranged sister find themselves drawn into a dangerous game of money and murder in a twisting tale of organized crime, cryptocurrency, and family secrets on the Las Vegas Strip. Chris is the number one New York Times bestselling author of 23 books, including Hour of the Witch, The Red Lotus, Midwives, and The Flight Attendant. His latest is The Princess of Las Vegas. And before a full house in Manchester Center, Vermont, we welcome Chris Bohjalian to this week's book show.
Thank you, Joe, and I thank you all so much. It is such a privilege to be with you, Joe, and to be with all of you at Booktopia.
What brought you to Las Vegas? What brought you to a Princess Diana impersonator? And then, oh, by the way, let's talk about cryptocurrency.
Sure. The book began when I was wondering, why is Diana Spencer still in the zeitgeist over a quarter century after her death? But I knew I didn't want to write about Diana herself, historical fiction, because it felt too soon. Her ex-husband, her children, her grandchildren are still alive. So I began to explore, why would someone be obsessed with Diana? So obsessed that they would want to be Diana and yet not be some sort of creepy, scary Windsor stalker. And it dawned on me that Las Vegas, the world of impersonators and tribute show performers. And I should note, I actually like Las Vegas. I don't gamble, but I'm fascinated by it. It is that fiery meteorite that shoots across the night sky. And in fact, my lovely bride and I, a few years before the pandemic, renewed our vows in Las Vegas at a little white chapel. You know, Sam Jonas, Sophie Turner, J-Lo, Ben Affleck, Chris and Victoria, all at a little white chapel, and everyone once in their life should see their soulmate walked down an aisle by Elvis Presley singing Love Me Tender with a really tight karaoke machine in his band.
Yeah.
So I thought to myself, let's put a Diana impersonator at a sleazy off-the-strip Las Vegas casino and see where this goes. Now, I knew it was going to be a book that was going to be more than that, because very often, violence, dread, crime, for me, are the MacGuffins to get at character. And I realized early on, this is not just about the woman who brings Diana Spencer to life two shows a night, five nights a week, but her sister from Vermont. And why are they estranged? And what are their demons? And what are their strengths?
It's interesting to me because, as you mentioned, the BP, as it's called in the book, the Buckingham Palace Casino, is not like bottom rung. It's getting to be bottom rung. It's old. It needs a good infusion, which is part of the backstory of money that could go in to make this place bigger and better. And yet, they have one of these, they have a star who this show sells. Like, the people know the Buckingham Palace because of what this woman does.
Yes. When I was researching the book, in August of 2021, I went back to Vegas just to see tribute shows and tribute performers. And the show that I really fell in love with is Carpenter's Legacy. And what fascinated me about Carpenter's Legacy is two things. First of all, the woman who brings Karen Carpenter to life is a Vermonter, and she is fantastic. She is Karen Carpenter, and her boyfriend is Richard Carpenter. But going back to Buckingham Palace, the fictional casino, and Diana, when I was watching Carpenter's Legacy, I was surrounded by people who were so moved and so into this. And, you know, the people beside me are saying, oh, honey, we danced to that at our wedding. Or, oh, my gosh, do you remember when Melissa and her boyfriend were dancing to that at the prom? And that's when it really clicked that even a shabby casino might have something to draw people in, something in the showroom. And, you know, one of the most fun things I did with this book was creating a fictional casino. I knew that this casino was going to be Excalibur meets Hogwarts.
Yeah.
But shabby. When I'd finished the book in September of 2022, the first Princess Diana Museum in America opened. And it opened in where? Las Vegas.
There you go.
Where else?
Now, is there a Princess Diana impersonator in Vegas currently?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't know if there's a Princess Diana impersonator anywhere.
Well, you've created quite the character here. And to the point of there are songs included in her show. She does have a foil. There's a man who plays
Charles.
And that adds a little bit to the show as well, and the tension. And the whole thing is, like, we all know, you bring this up in the novel, we all know this story has a tragic ending. And yet the performer does not want to leave that impression with the audience.
No. Now, one of the things that my fictional Diana, played by Vermonter Chrissy Dowling, talks about in the book is that the show never ends with a car crash. And it doesn't end with a car crash for a couple of reasons, because what does that mean? Where is she speaking to her audience from? Some strange netherworld, some strange heaven. You know, this isn't the Lovely Bones. This is a crappy casino in Las Vegas. One of the things that you have to do in a cabaret show in Las Vegas is be really entertaining. So she's singing Petula Clark. She's singing Dusty Springfield. She's singing all of these songs that people old enough to remember Diana and Charles's wedding in 1980 loved as young adults. So that is who her audience is, and she's figured that out early on.
There's a great scene in there where you have a bunch of impersonators together at this gathering. They look at her basically as sort of a star, because their residencies, you get into this whole fascinating thing where a lot of these people pay to have a residency. They're basically paying to have a show.
Yeah, going back to August of 2021 when I was in Vegas, among the things that I did that was really fun, and I've got two moments from that trip that I look back on in astonishment. The first is this. I went to a cocktail party at an off-the-strip casino filled with nothing but tribute show performers. You know, people who bring Michael Jackson to life and Prince to life and the Rat Pack to life. And some of them have got actual shows and casinos and nightclubs where they work maybe one or two nights a week. And some of them are just hoping to do somebody's anniversary party or somebody's birthday party. And they were all charming and talented and great. I know I had gone through the looking glass when I was chatting with pretend Prince, and he was taller than I was. My other favorite moment, and it had occurred that very day. Early in the morning, I was walking through the casino, the actual casino gaming floor, and it's August of 21. So, you know, most of us, you know, we've gotten our first shot, we've gotten boosted, but I'm still wearing a mask. And there were more people than not wearing masks on the casino floor. But I saw a whole row of people at the slot machines wearing masks, and they'd cut a hole in the mask for their cigarettes or cigars.
There you go.
And I thought, this is the most Vegas thing you are ever going to see.
That's
people
great.
At a slot machine with a mask with a hole in it for a cigarette.
Fantastic. Chris Bajalian is our guest in this week's book show. The name of the book is The Princess of Las Vegas, which is published by Doubleday. The mystery, if you will, comes in very early, where one of the owners of the casino commits suicide, we think. And then another owner goes. And that's when things start moving. And going back to an earlier question, this is where cryptocurrency comes into it as well. And I'll give you credit, because I've been reading about cryptocurrency for a long time, and I still cannot understand it to save my life. And you do a really good job of making sense of it, while also admitting that even a lot of the people involved don't know what it is.
I mean, cryptocurrency is the perfect currency for Las Vegas. It is built on a foundation of nothing. It is literally pretend money that one day can be worth bazillions and the next day can be worth nothing. Rather like anyone's fortunes in Las Vegas. Now, I will admit that cryptocurrency figures into the book, but I was never that interested in it. What I wanted was a reason for Chrissy Dowling's sister, Betsy, a Burlington, Vermont-based social worker, to have a reason to go to Las Vegas. And the reason is her money manager boyfriend is convinced he is the dude who is going to bring crypto to casino floors.
And that all just seems so plausible, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, when I was writing this book, history was moving faster than I could write. So, for example, when I finished a first draft of the book in January of 2022, most of the Vegas mob are made up of Russian oligarchs. But then, when Putin invaded Ukraine in February 2022, all of those oligarch jokes suddenly fell flat. Yeah. None of them worked anymore because of the horror of what Putin was raining down upon Kyiv and Kharkov and Ukraine. So all of a sudden I said, okay, you need a different kind of mob. So I recreated the mob, and the book was done again by the summer of 2022. And then Queen Elizabeth dies. That needed to be worked into the book in some fashion. So I did that change and I thought, okay, now we're done. And then in November of 2022, there's the FTX cryptocurrency scandal. And that's when I realized you need to put a flag in the ground and set this book not in what we call the amorphous present, but in a very specific moment in time, which is why the book is now set in the end of August and early September 2022. So Elizabeth, for example, dies in the context of the book, and Chrissy Dowling, one of the narrators, has to examine how she's going to reinvent her show now that her former mother-in-law has gone to that great castle in the sky.
You mention narrators. There is Chrissy, and then there's also Betsy, and then Marissa, who is the foster child and the adopted child, who basically appears in italics and very much like a teenager and sort of just goes back between I'm much smarter than the adults and they're annoying me.
Oh, Marissa, the 13-year-old foster child whose social worker Betsy Dowling adopts, might be my favorite character in the book. I love writing about kids, and I love writing about smart-ass kids. You know, foster children have appeared in at least two other of my novels, The Buffalo Soldier and Close Your Eyes, Hold Hands. And the thing about foster kids is really often they just need one grown-up to completely change the narrative and completely change their lives. When I started this book, I had no idea whether Betsy was going to be that grown-up. I never thought Chrissy had a prayer in heck of being that grown-up. But I was fascinated by Marissa, and I think she has most of the best lines in the book.
Yeah, there's a great line where she said, "I'd seen a lot of crazy shit, but I've never seen a person killed." This is what happens when you go to Vegas with...
I was actually thinking of the wholesome scene at the water park.
Yes. Well, and you know, there's an amazing relationship between Betsy and Marissa because they need each other, don't they?
They really do. I mean, Betsy is one of those really big-hearted, kind human beings who becomes a social worker. But like a lot of us, she was really scarred by 2020 in the pandemic. She realizes in 2020 that I'm in my mid-30s. I'm living in an apartment I'm renting at the edge of the University of Vermont that is the exact same kind of apartment that most parents rent for their 19-year-old kid. I'm not sure what the future holds for me, but when one of her social worker family's older sons shows up to pick up the kid's sister after counseling in a brand new Audi that he bought with his crypto money, she begins to rethink her future.
And of course, it's the guys in the book are the idiots, right?
They usually are in my books.
Yeah,
our gender just doesn't get it.
and then you have Marissa and Chrissy and Betsy, who are, you know, eventually get their act together. One of the things too we mentioned about the impersonator, here's this woman who spends a lot of time at a cabana by the pool, and just is, it's a strange life. And of course, you know, you got to be on Adderall and Valium. You can't not have that be a part of it, right? Because how else would you ever leave the room?
Chrissy Dowling, who plays Diana, is a mess. The fact is she is unhoused. She lives in a hotel room as part of this residency, as part of her contract. And this is not the kind of hotel room that Barry Manilow or Adele, you know, or John Legend get in their residencies. This is one room with a tiny sitting nook and a campus fridge. And that's her room, which is why she's always at the pool, hanging out in the cabana, which she's also worked into her contract. And yeah, she spends most of her life going into her goodie bag, which includes Valium, Adderall, and weed. And that is her life. But, like Diana, she also has an eating disorder.
And that plays a part. Was it because of the Diana connection that you added that?
Yes. That was a very, very big factor. Why would one human being be so obsessed with Diana? What is it that this human being sees in Diana? And the fact that they share that is a big factor in Chrissy Dowling's metamorphosis from New York City actor who, and you know, this is her bragging early in the book, has had a bunch of parts in NCIS, was the Emily in Our Town that John Mulaney liked best. And to, why does she trade it all to go to Las Vegas to do this?
How much of that did you know going in as you were writing it?
I knew most of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. My favorite women in my books are the women who are really damaged and unexpectedly strong. There's nothing I like to write more, I think, than a woman who you think is so flawed, she's not going to come out on top, but she shows an unexpected spine. And despite all of the scars from childhood and young adulthood, in the end, she's the strongest person in the room. And these two sisters are estranged. And they've been estranged for years. But the estrangement has become really pronounced a few years before the book opens, when their mother dies. And Chrissy Dowling in Las Vegas entirely blames Betsy Dowling in Vermont for their mother's death. And Betsy's really clear, you are wrong. And Chrissy's really clear, no, you are a killer.
When that aspect of it, I mean, these are things that possibly you could never get over.
No, no. And I'm always amazed. I'm just always amazed at the number of times that someone has said to me, well, no one ever suggested therapy.
Right.
And not that, you know, therapy is going to make Chrissy or Betsy's relationship better. But the fact is, they are both really traumatized by things that they need to be talking about.
Chris Bajalian is our guest. The name of the new book is The Princess of Las Vegas. It says on the jacket of the book, the princess is fake. The murders are real. Do you like writing murder mysteries?
I like writing books about dread. I don't necessarily love the idea that I'm writing a murder mystery, but I'm interested in the way ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances respond. And it changed my work. I love premium cable dramas and streaming dramas, and they changed my work. The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, The Wire, Mad Men, The Americans, Succession, all of them lean into dread, which is my own literary soft spot. And I'm going to say over the last 10 years, I've allowed myself to lean even more into anticipatory grief and mayhem. But again, it's all in the search for character. Why do we do what we do? So, yeah, the Princess of Las Vegas has casinos and crypto and a couple of corpses, but it was fundamentally for me a book about two really messed up siblings.
I love the phrase anticipatory grief.
I can't take credit for it. We see it manifest in our relationship to our pets. We love our pets madly,
yes,
but we always presume that we are going to outlive them and have to say goodbye to them, and it's going to be tragic and horrifying and heartbreaking for everyone in the world unless you're the governor of South Dakota.
But, well, that's a great way of putting it because, right, you just are waiting for that to happen, and it's just horrible.
It is.
Yeah.
And that's what my books, you know, they're not about pets. But, yes, that's what my books are about.
But what is it like to be in that space to write about that and to be regularly thinking in that manner, in that way, with grief, with dread?
Without wanting to use all of you in the audience for therapy, or all of you listening on the radio as therapy, a lot of my own demons are clearly about punishing myself and feeling guilty about everything, even, you know, something as simple as winning the birth lottery and being born in Westchester County, New York in the 1960s. And I think to a certain extent, if you are a sentient human being, you understand that. And so when I'm writing, I'm not depressed, but I'm certainly channeling or giving access to the reality that all of life is saying goodbye.
Right. And what do you think it is about that, about those ingredients that we as an audience love to read about?
Oh my gosh. How many people in this audience love the feeling of heartbreak when you finish a book? I mean, sometimes you want to read a book like Bridget Jones with a fairy tale happy ending.
Right. But not usually.
Not usually. I mean,
no.
And this is a new thing for me since the pandemic, since 2020. It is amazing to me how many times I will be running through the woods with my dog, listening to a book on audio, and the book will end, and suddenly I'm weeping in the woods with my dog. And I think this is really unexpectedly healthy. Because, I mean, until 2020, I literally never cried. I mean, I eulogized my dad without crying. I eulogized my mom without crying. I eulogized good friends without crying. But something happened in 2020. I broke in a way that was really good and healthy in some strange way. And so going back to your question, I love finishing books that break my heart. Books by other people. I love reading books that break my heart. And if you look at my, you know, this is my 24th book.
Yeah.
Not a lot of them have happy endings, but most of them sell pretty well. And so clearly I'm not alone in that I'm really comfortable with books that break my heart.
Does it change you as a writer since 2020, where in that capacity to cry, that there is an empathy, there is a concern, there is dread, as you mentioned earlier, that is more present perhaps than it was in the earlier books?
Gosh, empathy. That's a great word. I hope my books have always had some level of empathy, but... And I think this might be something you're getting at. It's harder for me to kill people in my books than it was in 2019. I pause a little bit more. And even in The Princess of Las Vegas, this was really important to me. When you write historical fiction or mysteries or thrillers, there's gunplay. And I friggin' hate guns.
Yeah.
And so in this book, because there are guns, I made sure that there is also an extended discussion of the Harvest Music Festival massacre in Las Vegas. Because it seemed important to me to remind readers that, okay, we're reading this dramedy. Because that's kind of how I view The Princess of Las Vegas, is a dramedy. But bear in mind, it's fiction. In reality, guns do way worse stuff than anything that happens in this book.
And there are characters who are using or in that room to see the Princess Di show, and they're using it as almost a bunker to stay away from the bullets that are raining outside.
When I was at that cocktail party for tribute show performers. I asked a bunch of them, where were you the night of the Harvest Musical Festival Massacre? And one of them told me that, oh, well, I was hiding under the piano with three members of the audience. Another person said, oh, you know, we were herding people backstage. We were herding people out of the theater into what we thought were safe rooms because so many of the casinos didn't know precisely where the massacre was occurring yet. They didn't know that it was at the southern end of the strip. They thought maybe it was at the northern. All they are hearing, we're hearing stories, and the cell phones are going crazy, that there's a shooter and there's carnage.
You plant that in the, say, two-thirds through the book, but then you still have to figure out what the ending's going to be and make it a barn burner, which it really is.
And I do love barn burners in fiction, and I love barn burners in the movie theaters, and I love barn burners on television. But I did try to modulate it. And I tried to modulate it in ways that would allow readers, and I'm not going to reveal the ending, would either give you a moment of unbelievable heartbreak. I've killed a lot of my main characters at the end of books. I won't say which of those books are, but I can think of three books I've written where one of the major characters dies in the last four pages. Or would this be a book with an unexpectedly happy ending for a book that I've written?
The name of the new book is The Princess of Las Vegas. It is published by Doubleday. Chris Bajalian, you are a master. I thank you so much for being with us. It's been an absolute delight to speak with you, to have you before this wonderful audience, and to share with us. It's always a treat. Thank you so much.
Joe, I thank you so much. You are the best in the world at this. You're just wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chris Bajalian's new novel is The Princess of Las Vegas. It is published by Doubleday. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuc. Kayla Sacco engineered our program. Write to us at book@wamc.org. Special thanks to Northshire Bookstore, northshire.com. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.